let's continue talking about the appendicular skeleton. Appendicular, as we already said, is going to be a continuation, or shall we say, an extension of the axial skeleton. The pectoral girdle, as we mentioned, girdles are going to be a variety of bone structures that are going to be making up a certain area. In this case, we look at the pectoral girdle. It's going to really make up our shoulder. It attaches the upper extremity to the body. It consists of the scapula and also the clavicle. Now, each scapula is going to be articulating with the body only at one spot. A lot of people think that the clavicle is somehow attached bone by bone in other areas, but it's really not. The shoulder really floats. And it floats because of its connection point. The only connection point that the shoulder has is going to be really at the sternum. So that shoulder has a great amount of movement, and therefore it can be very, very, very good at doing such things as throwing spears, throwing objects so you can kill wildlife, from also manipulating, you know, your shoulder up and down and around. You can do a lot of different things because of the fact that it has so much freedom of movement. The reason it has so much freedom of movement is because of its, if it's only one connection, and that's going to be more central in our body. So really, when we look at the sternoclavicular joint, this is going to be the only place where the shoulder connects to the rest of the body. So it really floats there. It really is going to be on our shoulders because of the muscles. So really it's a more of a muscular joint, even though of course there's the connection between the scapula and the clavicle. Nonetheless, it's still going to be very important for the muscles to be in balance for the shoulder to work properly. So therefore, most shoulder injuries you would think are going to be more muscular. Typically they're going to be, just because that's really what drives and also coordinates and also basically allows for the proper movement of the shoulder, even though there are those bony components as well. And certainly in my practice we see, you know, the shoulder going out of place, the clavicle can go out of place, the scapula can go out of place in relationship to each other, or even in relationship to the sternum. But really the only articulation, once again, is going to be right at the sternoclavicular joint. So to find this, what you do is you just go to the very, very top of your sternum, and there'll be a depression up there. Sometimes it might be a little tender in some people. And you'll notice to the left and to the right, there's bumps. Those bumps are going to represent your clavicle. So your clavicles are going to be on either side. Your clavicles sit in this joint, which is right at your sternum, really about halfway. I think it's even less than halfway. So the point is, it's not a very deep joint, but it doesn't need to be, because what it wants to really give to the shoulder is this mobility. So shoulders tend to go out of place more than, for instance, the hip would go out of place, because the hip's a ball and socket, whereas this is obviously a very superficial joint. But that's okay. Once again, you sometimes trade support, or shall we say stability, for freedom. You know, if you're single and you're going out dating a lot and all that, you're very, very free, but you have to admit that your home life is not all that stable. Until, of course, you get married, your freedom leaves, but you have the stability of a good relationship. So really, the freedom is sort of like counter to the amount of stability. So when we look at the clavicle, it attaches medially to the sternum at what we call the SC joint, or the sternoclavicular joint. And it connects laterally to the scapula. Here, we would call it the acromioclavicular joint, because that portion of the scapula is going to be called the acromion. So the clavicle is going to attach to the acromioclavicular area. So it's going to be the clavicle is going to attach to the acromion, which is that higher part of the scapula, and that's going to be more lateral. So that's why we call it the acromioclavicular joint. Now, when we look at these joints, we see that we're going to, well, first of all, we'll look at the bones. We look at the clavicle, and we see that the clavicle is going to be the most frequently broken bone in the body, and the reason that is because of the fact that it has a few things going for it, or shall we say going against it. Let's say it's going for it. It has an S shape. Now, any time that we have a confluence of bone going one way and a confluence of bone going the other way, where those two meet is going to be a problem area. particularly for stress. So if you see, for instance, a bone that's very, very thick, like picture the top of the femur as it comes down, the shaft of the femur. So the top is going to be very, very thick, and then it's going to start to thin out. As soon as it starts to thin out, that juxtaposition of it, the thinner part and the thicker part, is going to be where the bone's going to break. That's just the way that works. So if we look at the clavicle, we see that we have an S shape. We see that we have one S, or shall we say, one hook of the S meeting the other hook of the S. And right where those two meet, those two curves meet, that's going to be where it's going to break. So the clavicle is going to usually break in the middle. Now you then may ask, why is it most frequently broken? Well, because one of the most common injuries is going to be an individual falling. So usually when they fall, they don't fall backwards, they fall forwards. And the big thing they want to do is protect their head, because their brain's in there. So they instinctively know that you want to protect your head. So what do? You stick out your hands. As you stick out your hands and fall, you fall, of course, onto the ground or against something. And when that happens, then the force goes through your arm, and in your forearm, you have those two bones, the ulna and the radius, and they're connected by a ligament that goes crisscrossing. That tends to absorb a lot of the shock. That force then still goes into your humerus, then it goes up into your scapula and your clavicle. So the force, remember the scapula is really going to be held by muscles. So force going into them is just going to upset the muscles, but it's not going to really do anything to the bones. So the force is going to go through the anterior part of the body, and it's going to then go to the sternum. The sternum's not moving, so that reverberation of that pressure or that force is going to be then going to the next weakest spot, which will be where the S meets, where the one curve of the S meets and the other curve of the S meets, and therefore it's going to go right to the middle of the clavicle. So therefore, the clavicle is going to be breaking in the middle, and that's why it's most frequently broken, because a lot of injuries are going to be coming from falls. Now, we mentioned this S shape, and this has a positive thing. Anytime you look at a bone, you go, well, why is it shaped that way? A lot of times it can be explained by how muscles attach to it. Other times it can be explained by how the muscles work on the bones. Or, in this case, we can see that mechanically it's important for it to be in an S shape. So there's two reasons. And the first reason is it acts as a crank. So if we picture the old-time cars, like the Model Ts, where if an individual, they didn't have their own starter, so if an individual wanted to start it, had to get out and use a crank. And the crank was sort of S-shaped. And they would use that crank and crank around. You would not want to use a straight rod, because you couldn't really get enough force. So they give you this like S-shaped crank, and you would crank it, and then that would, of course, start the engine. Well, this is going to be like a crank as well. So what do we want to crank? Well, we want to throw something, like we want to throw a baseball. We have to have a crank set up. So we have that S shape, so that as we go back, the S is going to sort of flatten out, and then as we go forward, it sort of is like a, like just like the crank of that car. So it gives it momentum. So that's the first thing. So it's going to be for biomechanical advantage. That's going to be our first reason. Our second reason is going to be purely anatomical. If you take your hand and put it right next to your neck and push down in the front in your anterior part of your neck, you'll feel that curve that's going anterior of your clavicle. That's represented at the top of the our picture of the clavicle. So that initial curve goes way, way, way anterior. There's a reason for that, and I'll tell you what the reason is, or you can just experience the reason for yourself. Just take your fingers and stick them into your neck. Go medially, stick them into your neck, and you'll feel discomfort. The reason is because you're pushing on the nerves that go down into your arm. So it makes sense for our clavicle to want to go way, way anterior, and then as it goes way lateral, it's going to then go posterior. So what it has done effectively is gotten away from the nerves that are coming out of your neck. And that's a good thing. You don't want a bone sitting on nerves because nerves hate pressure. So those are the two reasons. One's going to be biomechanical and one's going to be purely anatomical. Now when we look at our scapula, we see that we have a very flat surface. Anytime you have a big flat surface, we call it a fossa. So if we look at the posterior part of our scapula, we'll see it's going to be very, very flat. And this makes sense because that's going to be the part that's going to be riding on the rib cage and riding on those muscles of the rib cage. So you want it to be fairly flat. But as you see, it's not totally flat. It has some ridges. Those ridges, of course, tell you that there has to be muscle attachments there. And the big muscle is going to be attached here. It's going to be the subscapularis. The subscapularis means sub means under, so it's going to be found under the scapula. And conveniently, the subscapularis muscle is going to be found in the subscapularis fossa. So they sort of fit together like that. Now, as we look at the underside, or really the anterior side of the scapula, I mean, if you were to look at somebody and look straight through them and have x-ray vision, be able to see past their ribs, what you would see is the anterior part of their scapula looking right at you. So the anterior part of the scapula will also have another feature. And this feature is going to be called the coracoid process. Coracoid, remember, oid means like. So coracoid means like crow. So we got a little bit of a crow's beak. Once you see it in the lab, you'll see it very clearly. It looks like a crow's beak. So this is going to be the anterior portion of the scapula. And the anterior portion of the scapula, then, is going to be where muscles are going to be attaching. So take your clavicle again, find that anterior part of the clavicle, remember that S shape. As it goes to the posterior, it's going to curve posterior. As it curves posterior, get right in the middle of that curve, go down, and you'll feel the coracoid process. Typically, it's going to be sore in individuals, particularly students, because they're bending over their books a lot. Now, when we look at the posterior portion of the scapula, we see that we have this thing sticking out. And that thing sticking out is going to be called the spine of the scapula. Now, the spine of the scapula, obviously, because it's being pulled out, is going to be an attachment for muscles, such as the trapezius muscle will want to attach here. The deltoid muscle will want to attach here. And just like we had a subscapular fossa, now on the posterior part of our scapula, we also have two fossa as well. We have an infraspinous fossa. That means it's going to be below the spine of the scapula. What do you suppose we call that fossa that's above the spine of the scapula? And that's going to be, of course, the supraspinatus fossa, or supraspinous fossa. Now within these fossa then are going to be just like we had the subscapularis muscle in the subscapular fossa. We're going to have a similar situation here. Inferior to the spine of the scapula, we're going to have the infraspinatus muscle in the infraspinous fossa. And the superior part, just above the spine of the scapula, that fossa, we're going to have the supraspinatus muscle in the supraspinous fossa. Now, also we're going to see that the spine of the scapula is going to terminate laterally. As it terminates laterally, we're going to see that it's going to stick out quite a ways above that little groove that's going to be called the glenoid cavity. Glenoid cavity, or glenoid fossa, is going to be the shell socket for the head of the humerus. So that little terminal part of the spine of the scapula is going to be called the acromion process. And the acromion process is going to be really beneficial in that it's going to prohibit a blow to the top of the shoulder from causing the humerus to dislocate. So the acromion process is going to be like a chrome guard, like in the old time cars where they had chrome bumpers, sort of like a chrome bumper, the acromion. That's going to be the extension then of the spine of the scapula. Now, when we look at fractures, you can see that we can fracture the clavicle, and of course it fractures right in the middle. But also there's some anatomical structures that you should notice on this x-ray. First one is we first see the very, very top arrow, and we see that's going to be the joint between the sternum, between the clavicle and the scapula. So therefore we're going to call it the acromioclavicular joint. That's that top arrow is going to be the end, the distal end of the clavicle. And the next arrow down, that next white arrow down, of course, is going to be the acromion process of the scapula. We then see our third arrow down, that black arrow, that's pointing at a very dense structure. That's going to be the most anterior part of the scapula. And if we saw it on the side, we'd see it looks like a bird's beak. So that's going to be called the coracoid process. And then the last arrow down, that black arrow, is going to be pointing to that shallow groove. It's going to be called the glenoid fossa or the glenoid cavity. Both would be acceptable. Now, the upper limb is going to be containing 30 bones. The upper part of the arm is called the brachium. And that's where the humerus is. Reason is because a lot of people, when they have a fall, they will brachium this part. Also, we have the antebrachium. Antebrachium contains the rest of the bones, these being the ulna and the radius, and also, I guess you could, that would be it, ulna and radius. Now, the radius is going to be on the thumb side, and the ulna is going to be on the small finger side. This is easy to remember because if you think of the anatomical position, your thumb will radiate out, or radius. And if you think of smelling something bad, you would want to close your nostrils with your small finger. So you would go PU, like closing your nostrils with your small finger. PU, pinky for ulna. So the ulna is going to be on your pinky side, and your radius is going to be on your thumb side. Now we also have the wrist. The wrist is called the carpus, because carpus means to seize, carpe diem. You may have heard of carpe diem, which is to seize the day. So carpus would be to seize as well. This is where we hold stuff, is in our wrist, in our palm. And then the hand itself is going to be having 19 bones totally. We're going to have 5 metacarpals, we're going to have 14 phalanges, and we're going to have 8 carpal bones. So when we look at the humerus, that's going to be in our brachium. And the head forms the shoulder joint with the glenoid cavity of the scapula. The muscles attach to the greater and lesser tubercles. These are going to be the areas of attachment that are going to be more proximal. And between these guys is going to be the intertubercular groove, which holds the bicipital tendon. So we have the greater and lesser tubercles. The tubercles is going to be an extension, almost like it's going to be a projection, a process. And between them, of course, is going to be a groove called the intertubercular groove. As we go down the shaft of the humerus, we get to a little bump, probably about halfway down. And this bump is going to be considered the deltoid tuberosity. It's called the deltoid tuberosity because the deltoid muscle has its attachment on the humerus here. Now, at the distal end of the humerus, we have the round capitulum. Now, the capitulum is going to articulate with the radius, sort of. It articulates with the radius when your arm is in full flexion. So if you were to try to make a muscle by contracting your biceps, that then would be when the radius would be connecting to the capitulum. But usually, there's not a lot of articulation with the head of the radius and the capitulum. There's more between the radius and the ulna, which we'll talk about in a minute. Now also, that's going to be then laterally, is the capitulum. Medial to the capitulum then is going to be the trochlea. The trochlea is a spool-like look to it. sort of like has like two grooves on the outside with a groove in the middle, and or two protuberances on the outside with a groove in the middle, and that's for the olecranon process to fit into it. So the olecranon, actually the olecranon fossa, will fit into that. The olecranon is going to be found on the ulna. So if you were to straighten your arm, for instance, and feel that bone that's back there, that thing that's sticking up, a lot of people call it the funny bone, that's really the olecranon process. The olecranon process is going to be on your ulnar bone. So if you flex and extend your elbow, you'll feel the olecranon process going between your fingers. And this then is going to be, it's going to be moving because the other side, or the anterior side of the ulna, has a groove called a fossa. And that groove is going right into the trochlea of the humerus. So as you flex and extend your arm, you can feel that they're definitely sliding inside of the elbow joint. Now your forearm muscles are going to be attached to the medial and the lateral epicondyles. We'll talk more about that when we talk about muscles, but for now, any of the anterior muscles of the forearm that will cause the anterior muscles of the forearm are going to cause the wrist to go into flexion. And those muscles that are going to be posterior on the forearm are going to cause the wrist to go posterior, or into extension. So flexion is going to be from the muscles in the anterior part of the arm, and extension is going to be from the muscles from the posterior part of the forearm. So flexion is always going to be coming from the medial epicondyle of the humerus. Whereas extensors, the muscles that are extending, will always come from the lateral epicondyle of the humerus. So the medial epicondyle will have the flexors. And you can even feel this. Just put your hand right on the medial epicondyle of your humerus and just cause your wrist to flex. And you'll feel those muscles contracting. Whereas if you were to go to your lateral epicondyle, you won't feel anything. But now, put your hand on your lateral epicondyle and then extend, and you'll feel the muscles bulge out to meet you. But go to the medial, and you'll feel nothing. Feel flexion, you'll feel the medial epicondyle. Then extension, you won't feel anything because the muscles are going to be attaching to, that extend, are going to be attaching to the lateral epicondyle. So now let's look at the ulna and the radius. The radius, as we said, is going to be articulating a little bit with the capitulum, but more with the ulna. There's a notch called the radial notch that's going to be on the ulna, and that's where the radius is really going to be attaching. Now the radius has the task of causing pronation and supination. So as you turn your hand up or you turn your hand down, that's going to be your radius bone assisting you in that. So because it can go in a rotatory fashion, we have to have a joint that's going to be allowing for that rotation. And that's going to be between the radius and the ulna at the radial notch. Now, there's also going to be a tuberosity. And a tuberosity typically is going to be where we're going to have attachment of muscles. And this tuberosity is going to be right at the elbow joint itself. This is going to be attachment for the biceps muscle. And we'll see later that the biceps has two functions. It has one function of flexing, just like if you took two barbells and just, you know, flexed your arm, you know, you would be working the biceps. But also the biceps has the ability to also do supination. And supination would be to have the hand, if you're standing in the anatomical position, which would be with your palms forward, if you were to bring your palms posterior and then bring them anterior, that would be called supination. So your palms are posterior, and you turn your hands forward, now that's going to be called supination. So that movement of supination is also what the biceps does. And you may see people at the gym actually accentuating that, where they would bring the barbells to their side, and with the barbell sort of like facing against their body. And then they would bring the barbell up and then rotate it as they come up. So they would be supinating it as they actually flex. That'd be a good way of taking care of both of the functions of the biceps, not just flexion, but also that supination aspect as well. Now the ulna is going to have the olecranon process, as we mentioned. Also has a trochlear notch. So the ulna is going to have the olecranon fossa that's going to go into the trochlea of the humerus at the proximal end. Also has the radial notch as well. Now, as we already mentioned, but let's mention it again, between the ulna and the radius, we have the interosseous membrane. This is a ligament that attaches the radius to the ulna. Now, this membrane is going to be assisting this in a variety of ways. One way, it's a nice pathway for blood vessels. Another way, it's, as we said already, going to be good for shock absorbing. Now, the carpal bones are going to be named, and we need to name them so we know what they are. And there's 8 bones total in the carpals. So the very, very, well, right where our wrist is, just distal to our wrist, going to be where these carpals are going to be. So the carpals are going to be arranged in 2 rows. We have a distal and a proximal row. It's going to be 8 bones. So they're conveniently divided into 2 rows of 4 bones each. Now what we do is we start to name them from lateral to medial. Then we need to use a mnemonic. So what we're going to do is to go from lateral to medial, and we're going to start at the, almost like at the base of the thumb, but not really, sort of more proximal to the base of the thumb. So we're going to start there, and we're going to call our first bone the scaphoid. Next then we're going to go to the, almost in the middle of our wrist. This is going to be called the lunate. Now to find a lunate, all you do is you take your hand and make sure you have your finger at the posterior part of your hand, and then just extend your hand. And if you feel on the back of your wrist crease, you'll feel an area that goes in. It makes like a little cavity. That area is going to be where the lunate is. And you can know if you're right, because what you do is you just flex your hand forward, and you'll feel the lunate push against your finger. So it's almost like in the middle of your wrist. There's a little cavity, and as you turn it, as you flex your hand forward, you can feel that lunate go into that hole that's being created by, when you extend, that hole is being created. Because what's happening is that the lunate is aptly named because it's shaped like a little, like a quarter moon. So whatever a quarter moon looks like, you know, it sort of looks like a little sliver. But the bone looks like that. And that quarter moon would be, if you were in the anatomical position, that quarter moon would be sitting right inside of your hand, and one part of the sliver of the moon would be anterior, the other part would be posterior. So as you extend your wrist, that one part of the quarter moon goes forward, so it makes a little gully posteriorly on your wrist. But as you flex your wrist, the other part of that sliver of the moon goes posterior, so it fills in that valley. So you can see that an individual who is constantly doing extension of their hand, such as always, you know, extending their hand too much, like at the typewriter, or at the keyboard, or extending your hand maybe not such a good technique for doing piano. You're extending too much, or someone who's actually in manufacturing and they have to like do stuff, like I've heard of people having this from repetitive injuries, such as, you know, pulling feathers off chickens and stuff like that. You constantly have a extension of your hand, and that can cause the lunate to go into the anterior portion of your hand, causing the tunnel to close down. And that famous carpal tunnel, the reason that a lot of people have carpal tunnel problems is because of the lunate. Put the lunate back in place, and their carpal tunnel will usually resolve. Because the lunate's gone too far anterior because of too much extension of their hand. And also what helps is to sleep with a neutral brace. So they'll have like a wrist brace on, but it'll be neutral. In the old days we used to think a cock-up brace was best. But all a cock-up brace does is it makes your hand go into extension. And that's exactly the last thing you want, because that's what the injury was caused from. So now we use a neutral brace, a little piece of metal inside of a wrist brace, just to keep a person's hand straight so that when they're sleeping they don't cause too much extension on that joint. So that's our lunate. Next to our lunate then is going to be our trochanterium. And that's difficult to find because it's deep to the other bone called the pisiform. So if we find the pisiform, which is going to be really that bone that's going to be most medial on our hand, you can't really miss it. It's sticking out there, most medial. So you'll find that guy just sticking out there, and then there's the bone beneath it, and you just have to sort of realize that it's beneath it. You really can't feel it that well. I mean, you can't feel the distinction between the pisiform and that, really. But you know where the pisiform is, and the trochanterium is going to be just below that. So that's our first four bones. First of all, I have laterally, like at the base of our thumb, a little bit more proximal. That's going to be our scaphoid. And then we go to our lunate, which I took time to talk about. Our trochanterium is going to be underneath our pisiform. And then we're going to go then lateral for our next row, our distal row. And our distal row will indeed be right at the base of our thumb. That's where we start. That's going to be called the trapezium. So the trapezium is going to be right at the base of the thumb. Then we're going to go then medial, and the next bone is going to be called the trapezoid. Then we're going to go medial to that, almost right at the crease of your palm. That's going to be the capitate. And then next to the capitate is going to be the lunate. Now the way you find the lunate is pretty easy. What you do is you take your thumb, and your thumb has a crease in it. Take that crease and put it right on the pisiform. Put it right on the pisiform and then go into your palm, and you'll feel right at the pad of your thumb that you will feel the hook of the hamate. And that hook of the hamate is going to be really that part that's going to be more anterior of the hamate bone. Now you've heard of carpal tunnel, and carpal tunnel really is going to be that lunate and also the capitate, but really the lunate's the primary bone of that tunnel. But there's also another tunnel called the tunnel of Guillain. The tunnel of Guillain is going to be between the pisiform and the hook of the hamate. There's a nerve, the ulnar nerve, that goes through there. Sometimes people can have manifestations of medial hand pain, as well as the last two fingers discomfort from a problem with the tunnel of Guillain. So then we need to use a mnemonic to make us realize these things. So that mnemonic is going to be something that you can email me about, and I'll email it to you. Or you can go online and see if there's any mnemonics out there to help you to remember the carpal bones. So now when we look at the articulation of the hand with the antebrachium, we're going to be seeing that the ulna is not going to have any articulation with the wrist. It's there indeed, but there's no articulation with the wrist. There's a fibrocartilage connection, but no bony connection to the wrist. And this is for movement. You know, we can move our wrist in, we can move our wrist out. We have a lot of movement. So we only really have two bones that are going to be articulating with our radius. And our radius then is going to articulate with the scaphoid and the lunate. These are the only bones that articulate at the wrist. So we're going to be articulating this with the ulna. Now the ulna, with the radius. Remember that the ulna is thicker in our proximal end. It's thinner and smaller at our distal end. whereas the radius is thinner at the proximal end, but then it starts to branch out and get bigger at our distal end. So it's at this distal end that we're going to be articulating our radius with our scaphoid and lunate. That being the case then, we just said that a lot of injuries are going to be from a person falling. A person falling forward, putting out their hands. We said that a lot of the force is going to go through the hands, and then that causes the clavicle to fracture. However, possible for the force to go just into the hand and cause it to fracture. So of the two bones, the scaphoid or the lunate, which one do you suppose will fracture more? If you chose the scaphoid, you'd be right. And why would that be? Well, because of what we just described about the lunate. The lunate can actually move. Can actually move more anterior. So because it can move more anterior, it can basically get out of the way of the force. Whereas the scaphoid is not so lucky, it has to stay there. So because there's only two bones that are going to be causing the articulation at the wrist, the scaphoid, lunate, and the radius, you would think then that those bones that would be breaking would be the scaphoid, and probably the radius too, a lot of times. So just anatomically we can sort of figure these out if we know functionally, physiologically, what they're doing as well. Now as we go then more distal from our carpal bones, we meet our metacarpals and then our phalanges. Phalange is going to represent a phalanx. It's going to be like a line of soldiers. If you picture like the old time movies where you have soldiers marching by, those would be a phalanx. So because the fingers sort of line up as if they were soldiers, they call them phalanxes. So we have the five metacarpals that come off the carpals. This is going to be the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth metacarpal. And if we make a fist and we look at our knuckles, we'll see the ends of our metacarpals, or the heads of the metacarpals. That's what your knuckles are. So your knuckles then represent the end of the metacarpals, and then the folds of your fingers represent the phalanxes. So if you take your thumb and fold that down, flex it, you'll see that there's only two bones in that. There's only one crease. Whereas if you flex your index finger, you see that there's three creases. That means there's three bones in there. So the thumb only has two phalanx, and the rest of the fingers have, of course, three. Now why is that? Well, so that we can grab something. When we have our thumb only needs two because it's going to be going through mostly opposition, which is going to be going towards the small finger, and that's going to be then for us to hold stuff. Now, speaking of holding, take something, a pencil or something a little bit thicker maybe, or even your index finger, put it inside of your other hand and just pull down, and index finger is not the greatest, index finger is okay. So stick your hand around your index finger and squeeze. And what you'll see is that your last phalanx and your head of your fifth metacarpal will be sort of shorter. Your fourth one is going to be a little bit longer. Your third metacarpal is going to be the longest. And your second metacarpal is going to be a little bit shorter than your third. Now why is that? Well, that's so that when you grasp something, your fifth metacarpal will actually push down on whatever you're grasping. The fourth one will as well. The third one will as well. But then your second metacarpal will actually, because it's shorter than your third, will actually pull down on that as well that you're grasping. So it's sort of like a vice. You have your fifth metacarpal that's really clenching down on that whatever you're trying to hold, and then you have your others that are actually supporting in that vice grip kind of hold. So that's really the anatomy behind your metacarpals and your phalanx as well. Now let's talk about the phalanx. In the fingers, we have three of them. So we call our first one that's closest to our metacarpal, we call that the proximal phalanx. Our one that's most distal or furthest away, we call it the distal. And the one that's going to be between the distal and the proximal phalanx, you would think we call them medial, but that would be wrong because medial is going to be closer to the body. No, we just call them the middle. So it's going to be called the middle phalanx. So the one that's closest to the metacarpals, we call it the proximal phalanx. Then we go into the middle phalanx, and finally the distal phalanx. Now let's look at the lower part of our appendicular skeleton here. We're going to be talking about the pelvis. Now the pelvis is going to have some components of our axial skeleton. We're going to be having the sacrum here as well as the coccyx. But we're going to be attaching the pelvis to the sacrum and the coccyx. So really the pelvis is going to be composed of four bones. We have the right and left hip, we have the sacrum, we also have the coccyx. The pelvis is going to support the trunk and the legs and also protect the viscera. So we have, like, for instance, the bladder is going to be protected by the pubic bone. The sides of the pelvis are going to protect the intestines. So you see there's going to be a bony, you know, protection there. In a female, the uterus is going to be protected bonally by these bones, by the pelvis. So we're going to have some protection. Now each hip is going to be joined to the vertebral column at the sacroiliac joint. So this joint is going to be between the sacrum and the ilium. The ilium is going to be that hip joint. It's going to be that hip. So this is going to be the hip joint then. It's going to be between the sacrum and the ilium, called the sacroiliac joint. Now anteriorly, there's going to be the pubic bones. They're going to be joined by a pad of fibrocartilage to form the pubic symphysis. So a symphysis is always going to be a midline structure. And we talked about the symphysis being between the two vertebrae, where they form the disc. So this is a symphysis as well. So we're going to be having the symphysis here between the two pubic bones anteriorly. And of course, around this would be pubic hair. We also have faults in a true pelvis, which are separated at the pelvic brim. Now, the true pelvis is going to be really a bony portion. So if you really have to see this in the lab, it would be the best. But what you'll see is an actual ring of real bone, and that's going to be depicted here by the two arrows. So we see that it's going to be really just true bone. So we're looking at the sacrum. We're looking at the sides on the inside of the pelvis. We're looking at the pubic bone. We're seeing that whole thing being the true pelvis. Now above the true pelvis, or superior to it, is going to be a rim of the pelvis. We have the brim of the ilium. And the ilium has that nice wide fossa called the iliac fossa on either side. And so that's going to be part of the false pelvis. So the false pelvis really doesn't have an anterior portion to it. It has a lateral portion to it, the iliac fossa, but it doesn't have an anterior portion to it. So that's why they call it the false pelvis. Now the infant's head has to pass through the true pelvis. So a lot of times the doctor will make an estimate on how big the mother's true pelvis is to determine whether or not the kid is going to be able to be born naturally. Now when we look at the hip bone, or that pelvic bone, I guess we could call it, we have the acetabulum. Now the acetabulum is going to be the hip joint socket. The acetabulum is literally going to be a vinegar cup. So in the old days, they used to have these cups that had vinegar in them, and anatomists at the time said, "Oh, you know, this portion of the looks like a vinegar cup to me. I'm going to call it the acetabulum." So acid for vinegar, and so we have a vinegar cup there. The vinegar cup is going to be divided into three different portions. Now, the ilium is going to be superior, so therefore the top part of the acetabulum is going to be representative of the ilium. The pubic bone, as you know, is going to be anterior, so that's going to be one part of the acetabulum as well, the anterior part. You also have a posterior part to the acetabulum, and that's going to be the ischium. So therefore you have three bones that are going to fuse at the acetabulum. Superiorly the ilium, posteriorly the ischium, and anterior the pubic bone. So these guys are going to form a Y, and that Y then is going to fuse in later life so that we can have a secure joint between the head of the femur and also this part of the hip bone called the acetabulum.